Well, welcome everyone to this evening session. I'm Roy Hammerling from Concordia College, if this is your first time here. Before I begin, I do a thing that I do with students, we call mindfulness moments, just taking time to kind of find a way into the classroom and find a way into the conversation. I guess here a little bit is better. Just like to take some moments of silence, and then I just do a few readings, and then at the end of the silence, and then we'll dive into for tonight's topic. So let's take our a few moments of silence, and we'll begin. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me from the words of my groaning? My God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night I find no rest. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our consciences, but shouts to us in our pain and suffering. It is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Darling, the body is but a guest in this house. Every morning someone new arrives. Don't say, oh, another weight around my neck, or your guest will fly back to nothingness. Whatever enters your heart as a guest, from the invisible world, so entertain it well. Every day and every moment, a thought comes like an honored guest into your heart. My soul regarded each thought as a person, for every person's value is in the thought that they hold. If a sorrowful thought stands in the way, it is simply preparing the way for joy. It furiously sweeps your house clean in order that some new joy might appear from the source. It scatters the withered leaves from the bough of the heart. It orders the fresh green leaves so that they might grow. It uproots the old joy so that a new joy may enter from beyond. The second reading about God whispering to us in our pleasures is from C.S. Lewis, and the last reading is by Rumi. So come on in and find a place in it. Glad to have you all here this evening. For this week, I've been working through the topic called the Mysterium Fundum, the terrible, wondrous, awesome, beautiful mystery of God. We looked at nature and community the last few days, and today we're going to look at suffering. I've talked about this notion of a Celtic notion that there are thin places in the world, and these thin places are places that we come into close contact with the divine, and we have these moments, what I like to call thick moments, where sometimes time seems to slow down and stop and something meaningful happens to us in a way that we suddenly see the world in a new way. And I've suggested that there's a number of places that this sort of thing can happen. And I think most of us can appreciate that there are thin places in nature. We're around them all the time here. In community, we can understand that. Even in joy, which I'll talk about tomorrow, that seems to make sense. Intimacy, that sounds great. Imagination, sure, I get that. Mindfulness, well, okay, if I figured that out, is that is, I might get that. Study, okay. Silence, death. Yeah, I think that's true. Death and suffering seem like they shouldn't probably be on the list, right? Suffering seems a little bit out of place. How is suffering a mindfulness moment? I thought about just starting this presentation by asking the same questions that I put into the little blurb so I could get you here, right? You know, why is there suffering? Is there evil? And I would say, I have no idea. We'll see you later. Call it an evening, go out and get some ice cream. But what I want to do is I want to talk about tonight kind of the way the medieval mystics, I'm going to go back in time and spend a lot of time in the Middle Ages today. I want to go back to how the medieval mystics looked at the notion of suffering. And it's not quite the same way we look at it. But hopefully, I'm going to be about halfway through this talk, and I know every one of you in here is going to go, where is he going with this? You know? But trust me, we'll get to it in the end. But we have to do some background work in order to get us to where we need to be, I think, in this way. I found remember I've made this comment about Lewis thinking about we need to go back to the ancients to understand human nature a little bit. And I find, you know, particularly in the area of suffering, for me, I found a lot of comfort in looking back at some early authors. Let me introduce one of them to you right now. His name is John Towler, and I'm going to preach on him in Vespers tonight as well. John Towler is a very interesting guy, born around the year 1300, dies in one of the reoccurrences of the Black Plague in 1361. One of the interesting things, he was a Dominican friar. He was a religious. He was a mystic author. He was very, very popular. He spoke mostly to Dominican nuns in monasteries, and they wrote down his sermons, and we have a collection of them, which thankfully has survived. Luther had his own private collection of this, which is well annotated, and Luther says of Towler that he was the purest and truest German theologian that ever lived. So Luther was profoundly affected by Towler, especially in Luther's idea of the theology of the cross. Well, Towler probably lived in the time of the world when we saw the greatest suffering. The bubonic plague, as it's sometimes called, these inflammations of the bubos under the armpits and the lymph glands and in the groin that turned black and blue, which came from fleas that were on black rats that came on boats from the east and came to Europe, killed one-third of the people in Europe. And when I try to illustrate this with my students, I say, how many of you are from a family of three or more with your parents? And they all suddenly realize that probably nobody went untouched in the Middle Ages with this death. We know in Florence, for example, that over 50% of the people died in Florence. It was a tremendous tragedy, tremendous suffering. And Towler was preaching during this time and talking. He lived in Strasbourg, Germany, and he really has some very interesting ideas. I'm going to give you a few of his thoughts, and then I want to talk about one of his sermons. He says that one of the problems that we have in the world is that as human beings, in his sermons, he talks about this idea is that if we would like to be in a relationship with God, he goes back to the Psalms. He says, we must lift our hearts to God. So how do we lift our hearts to the divine? Well, it's hard, says Towler, if you think about it, because there are some things that get in the way. I can never remember the seven deadly sins, except in Latin, so I'm going to write them down. The Latin word "solidium" means nothing. It's just an anagram. So the first one is superbia. The first of the deadly sins says Towler, is the worst of the deadly sins. It is pride. And the problem with pride is that when you focus on yourself, you get weighed down by your desires that hook you into the passions of the earth. And so if your passions are tied to earthly things, that's the rest of the list, you cannot lift your heart because you're not physically, spiritually capable enough to lift your heart to the divine because you're so weighed down. You'll probably guess these words. The second one is avarice, the second of the deadly sins, the love of money. Luxuria is the Latin. Can't talk and write at the same time. You can guess that's lust. Ira, or hatred. Gula, gluttony, which for the medievals was both eating and drinking, so you can be a glutton of drinking if you drink too much wine or to eat too much. Invidia, or envy. And last but not least, my favorite, Achadia, sloth. Now, being slothful. So now, Towler says, we follow these things, and he's very Augustinian in this point. Augustine, in the 5th century, writing in his Confessions, has this marvelous line. He says, "My love is my weight. My love is my weight. Whatever I love, that is where I am caught up. That's my being. It weighs me down. So how am I lifted up? Well, for Towler and others in the Middle Ages, what you did is you had to somehow free yourself of the seven deadly sins. How could you do that? Well, you have the seven virtues, right? And they're the exact opposites of the seven deadly sins. So what's the opposite of pride?
Humility.
Humility. Okay. You got this. Avarice.
Charity.
Charity, generosity. How about lust?
Purity.
Chastity.
Being chaste. Hatred.
Love.
Gluttony. What's that?
Moderation.
Yeah, there's actually two. The people that knew Aristotle said moderation. Yeah, they went to Aristotle says moderation on all things, right? So you could use moderation or fasting or something like that. So moderation. Envy. It's the opposite of envying somebody.
Gratitude.
Gratitude, kindness, showing kindness to someone. And slothfulness. Let me explain slothfulness. I love the medieval definition of slothfulness. It kind of cuts both ways. We tend to think of slothfulness as the people that are really honored in our movies today, right? Young men who live at home or don't have any, you know, it's kind of any of the Judd Apatow films, you know, the male character, and they're kind of men out of control, and they're slothful, and they can never hold a job, and they drink and party and do that all the time. But in the Middle Ages, the definition of sloth was, you have been given a gift by the divine, and what you're supposed to do with the gift is use that gift. So slothfulness is not using the gift. And an example that I'd like to give is, for example, let's say I have a student who came to me once who skipped the final in the exam, and he got an F, of course, because you know. And he came to me and says, "Well, I was in a marathon. I was running a marathon for charity. So isn't that worth anything?" I said, "Yes, it's worth an F." You know, and I told him the definition, medieval definition of sloth. Even though he's running and doing a good thing, he's still avoiding the thing that he should be doing. It's his main task. He's being slothful while he's running. So we can be slothful when we're working very hard when we're not doing the right thing. So that's the medieval definition. So, you know, I'll leave that one without a word there.
Pardon?
Diligence. diligence would be a good way of putting that down. So now, we got Augustine saying, my love is my way. G.K. Chesterton once said, that great Catholic author who is quotable, I quote him all the time, so G.K. Chesterton said, why is it that the angels can fly? It's because they take themselves lightly. And what we need to do as humans is to take ourselves lightly. In humility, we lift the load or the weight which ties us to the earth, says Tauler, and as do many other medieval authors. So confession and is the beginning step of, first of all, acknowledging that you have this weight that keeps you from the divine, so that keeps you from lifting your to the heart to the divine. And then when you finally are able to do that through confession and finally longing for the divine, then that's the thing that you want to get involved. So how does this longing come about? And now I want to read a sermon to you by John Tauler. Tauler is quoting on Psalm 42, verses 1 to 3. And I want to read those so you're aware of what his context is. As the deer longs for the flowing stream, so my soul longs for you, O God. My soul thirsts for you, O God, for the living God. When shall I come and behold the face of God? My tears have been my food day and night, while people say to me continually, where is your God? So the psalmist is in some suffering, and he compares himself to a deer longing for flowing streams. Tauler's sermon. A deer was grazing calmly on some grass early one morning, when suddenly an arrow struck the tree above its head. Instinctively, the deer leaped high into the air and burst into speed and crashed through the underbrush and bounded over the hill. The hunter, undaunted, pursued on horseback, loosing his dogs, straining its limbs to the limit. The deer, wide-eyed with panic, did its best to outrun the dogs, who worked together and forced the deer up against the side of a cliff. One dog, attacking from the side, sunk its teeth deep into the deer's belly, but the deer spun quickly around, smashing the dog against a tree. The dog yelped, loosed its deadly grip, and the wounded deer once again ran for safety. The entire day and into the early evening, the dogs bellowed, the hunter followed on horseback, chasing the deer, never giving it a moment's rest. Finally, as dark covered the forest, the hunter called the dogs off. The deer, utterly exhausted, overcome with thirst and hunger, paused by a small trickling brook, barely able to move. It bent its wounded head and put its mouth into the water and drank the fresh, cool drink. The deer drank until it forgot itself in the water. It forgot the blood flowing from its side. It forgot its tired muscles. It forgot its own self and was absorbed and lost in the water. So, says Tauler, ought our thirst to be for God, who hunts us and allows us in life at times to be quite hard-pressed. Yes, God allows us to be tempted sorely, often with great suffering. But when temptation grabs hold of us, we must dash it against the tree of the cross. And once free of them, then we will be able to make our way to the stream. There let us drink so that we might lose ourselves in that living water which is God. For Jesus said, if anyone is thirsty, let her come to me and drink, for I am living water, and if you drink of me, you will never be thirsty again. Perhaps one of the problems we have in the modern world in thinking about suffering as a thin place by which we might come close to the God is that we probably have never really been thirsty for anything in our lives. We may get thirsty on the hikes that we take around here because we didn't bring enough water, but we always kind of make it back. We've never been to the point of longing that this deer has been in. The same thing is true out of hunger. I could use the metaphor of hunger, but the towler is really interested in the metaphor of thirsty, so I'll stick with that. Maybe because we've never really known how to thirst physically, we're not sure how to thirst spiritually. Now, I have to take a step, and now I know you're going to wonder where I'm going, so just hang on. But in the Middle Ages, if you look at sermons, the most popular sermons that you can find are usually on the Psalms or the Gospels, but very close to the top of the list is a series of sermons that most people preach in the Middle Ages on the Song of Songs. It was one of the most popular books in the Bible that they preached on. Now, for those of you who know anything about the Song of Songs, you know that it is an erotic love poem. And I don't know about you, well, let me just read it. I mean, it's utterly beautiful, but it's also embarrassing at times. Kiss me with the kiss of your mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your name is perfume poured out. I will praise you more than wine. Upon my bed at night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields, and there I will make love with you. I never told my kids to read this passage. You know, have you ever noticed, I remember back in 1972, I was part of the ALC. They had this program about reading the Bible through in 72. Do you remember this program? And so my parents were diligent ALC Lutherans, and I remember we started in Genesis, and we were going to read through the Bible, and we got to the rape of Dinah, and I remember my dad grabbing the Bible and going, well, that's enough of that. You can do that on your own, but I'm going to tell you what you can read. You know? So there was these sort of embarrassing things, and I remember trying to trick my kids at one point. I put a bunch of books up on a shelf and said, you can't read those, have the Bible tucked in there. Pretty soon they're reading them. Modern folk are really shocked, I think, by the Song of Songs. Many people preach on the Song of Songs, Fred? Is that?
Just at weddings.
Just at weddings. Okay, we'll warm you up, folks. Here we go. But it's really interesting. Why in the Middle Ages was this text so popular? Is because partially Bernard of Clairvaux has 100 sermons on the Song of Songs. He barely gets like two words and he gets a sermon and then he goes, you know, to another one. And it's because in each of the sermons in the Middle Ages, they compare God to the lover and the person, the church, to the beloved, but individually also people as the beloved. Now, one of the theories I have about why we don't preach about it is because I think we've equated love with lust in our modern world. If you look at magazines, if you look at movies or television or whatever, love seems to be the moment when the people get into bed together, right? And we're not quite sure how to deal with that in the Christian church, especially with young kids sitting in the pew. So, but love, if you think about it, has a great deal to do with longing. And the medieval authors knew that. And so they would allegorize the Song of Songs in a way that would say, God is this lover that is pursuing you. He wants to woo you. God wants to take you out and be his lover and talk about your beauty and be a part of your life. Now, as if you think about lovers for a moment, lovers do crazy things. When you were in love, didn't you do crazy things? The other day I told the story about my wife and I told her that I was in love with her for the first time and she didn't really respond. Well, after a time she did and she started falling in love with me and then crazy things happened. I would write her poetry, which was pretty bad. I've read it since and it's not very good. And I would send her, you know, do little things, send her flowers or leave little notes here and there. And really kind of out of character. I was a little bit insane. I was losing myself in her because I was longing for being in a relationship with her. And you'd kind of do silly things, right? And I even promised, I when I told her that I was wanted to marry her, I called her father and I said, I would like to ask for your daughter's hand in marriage. And I said, I want to sell my comic book collection. And he said, why do you want to do that? Because it's the only way I can afford a ring for your daughter, so I can marry her. and so it was a crazy, now I love my comic book collection, and it was a crazy thing to suggest. And so that's what love loses itself in others. And love has a great deal of suffering. My wife and I dated for 5 years. It was an on-again, off-again thing. It wasn't always easy, you know. It was long distance, and it didn't always work. And I bet a lot, that story is true for you. You've all struggled through things. But if you think about the great lovers of history, think about the suffering that they had. Let me just list some of the names. Romeo and Juliet. Guinevere and Lancelot. Arthur and Lancelot? No, Arthur and Guinevere? No. That's in the Spamalot. Anthony and Cleopatra? Orpheus and Eurydice? Abelard and Eloise, if you know that great medieval story. Odysseus and Penelope? Tristan and Isolde? Now I'll do some more modern ones if you don't know the ancient ones. Pocahontas and John Smith? Jane Eyre and Rochester? Katniss and Peeta or Gale, if you did the Hunger Games. Harry Potter and Ginny Weasley. Bella Swan and Edward Cullen. That's for younger people. We don't understand longing very much. We don't quite understand who, you know, this notion that Towler is trying to get at, that we need to lift our hearts to the divine, but not you can only do that with great longing, and it's a longing that's willing to kind of put everything else aside, like Towler says, into the drink, into the water. G.K. Chesterton, again, wrote a book called The Everlasting Man in 1925, and in there, he says, he has an explanation for why we don't long very well. He says, it's a very simple story. He says, there comes a time in the afternoon when little boys get tired of playing cops and robbers, and it is then they torment the cat. Chesterton goes on, he says, there comes a time in the afternoon of our lives when we as adults get tired with our lives. We become bored and numb with who we are. It is as if we are walking around in our dreams and we try to wake ourselves up with our nightmares. I've often thought that Chesterton's insight gives me an insight to why horror films are so popular with young people. Young people in today's world are numbed by all the world that's around them, the media, the phones that they're always on, and all those sorts of things. And why do they go to horror movies? They love horror movies. I think they go because they're numb. And feeling the shock of horror is better than feeling nothing at all. And when I've talked and worked with students on that, they often say, yeah, I think that's right. I think that's where I'm at in this sort of world. So the question for Towler is, first of all, how do we waken ourselves in a world? And then once we are awakened from the numbness of our lives, which happened through all of these sorts of things, which they make us numb, once we're awakened from the numbness, how do we start longing? How do we start pursuing the divine? And you're probably wondering, where is suffering? So I have to get to St. John of the Cross. 16th century now, we're moving 300 years after Towler. The young man, St. John of the Cross, grew up in 16th century Spain, contemporary of Luther. He grew up in tremendous poverty and great suffering. His father died when he was three. His mother had to go to the relatives and beg for food or firewood just so that they could have fire in their house. Eventually, he became a Carmelite friar and the friend of Teresa of Avila. During his life, he became a part of a very, I guess you'd say, kind of extreme religious group. They were called the Descalced Carmelites, which meant they didn't wear shoes, and they did things kind of in an extreme way. And some of the order thought he was a little too extreme, so they threw him in a prison and left him there. And for many years, he suffered terribly while he was there, and eventually he escapes. And he gets out, and he becomes probably one of the greatest poets the world has ever seen, but certainly one of the greatest religious poets that we've ever seen. And he agreed that with Tauler, that God is a lover that does strange things in that loving relationship. That God is a mystery that's beyond us. And if we want to try to understand God, we can't really do it. But he said, let's think about it in terms of the Song of Songs. He turns back to the same story. And he quotes this passage, upon my bed at night. Now the lover is going to bed. The beloved really is going to bed. The lover who loves the beloved is not in bed yet. Upon my bed at night, I awoke, and I sought him, whom my soul loves. I sought him, but he wasn't there. I found him not. I called him. He gave no answer. So I will rise now. I will go into the city, into the streets, into the squares, and I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him. I found him not. Upon my bed at night, I sought him whom my soul loves, but I found him not. It's a little passage within. John of the Cross looks at this passage and says, have you ever felt this moment where you're in love, be smitten by the one you love, and in the middle of the night you wake up and they're not there? What would that be like? What would you think? Has my lover run off with somebody else? Has my lover been killed? Is my lover ill on the way to the house? I must find my lover. And John of the Cross called this the dark night of the soul. There comes a point in life, says John of the Cross, that the night is so dark that your soul aches with such longing for the lover that you love, in this case, the divine, and you cannot find God. Suffering is the abandonment of God in our lives. When I was 23, I had a lump that I went into the doctor to check out. I didn't think anything of it. I was 23. I was going to live for another 800 years, so what was I worried about? Went into the doctor, and he said, we think this is cancer. Okay. So I went through the surgery, and my favorite word now is benign. But some of you have not heard that word, and some of you know that when you heard the word, it's almost as if the beloved snuck away in the night. Physical suffering. There is spiritual suffering or deep spiritual anguish that we can have. Some of us live with depression. Some of us live with the loss of a loved one. I mean, literally, the bed is empty next to us. And John of the Cross says, we all will experience the dark night of the soul. This comes to us. Some more difficult than others, but certainly it will come. And I was asked to speak on this topic of suffering at Concordia one night, and about 500 students were at this worship service in Eucharist. And I said that night, I said, you know, you're all so young, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but you will all suffer. You all have your dark nights. This is what John tells us, this is what the scripture tells us, this is what we've heard through the ages. Now, C.S. Lewis was actually commenting on John of the Cross in one place, and he said, Lewis noted that even Jesus had his times of abandonment. Even Jesus, when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me, had his own dark night of the soul. So who are we to presume that we will not have one? Or, when we have it, that it is not? That is spiritual arrogance. There are many religious traditions who deny the fact that we sometimes are in this place that Luther sometimes called the abyss. The great emptiness, this dark night of the soul, a place where we are suddenly left alone with only our longing, like the deer standing, waiting for the dogs to be called off, or hoping they'll be called off, and not hoping, you know, standing there thinking that this is the end, this is all, I can't take it anymore. I read with my students the beautiful memoir of Mother Teresa called Come Be My Light. I don't know if you've ever read the book or know anything about it, but it's a book that should never have come to be in print. It was her confessor who, she would write her confessions to him when she had the opportunity because they weren't always in the same town. And the only stipulation she had is that he would burn her confessions. And he took these writings to the Pope and asked what he's supposed to do. Is he supposed to burn these beautiful testaments of this work? And the Pope said, no, we'll print them. And they're in the book, Come Be My Light. It's an astonishing story. You all know Mother Teresa's story. She was a Yugoslavian nun who had a vision that told her that she should go to Calcutta. She had these visions in a mystical experience where she went and had this experience of the divine. And when she gets to Calcutta, what she tells no one but her confessor is that suddenly the voices stopped. And she went into a dark night of the soul in which she questioned whether God loved her or cared for her at all, or if God's presence was even anything that she could ever long for again. So she says, after a long period of writing and trying to figure out what's going on, why has God abandoned me? She said, I had to go to the place where I thought I could find God's face. And that was only in the poorest of the poor. And there she glimpsed God, her lover, and that's why she loved the dead and dying infants that were mostly in the Calcutta garbage dumps where she picked them up. That was the only place she could find the glimpse of the divine. The invisible hunter chases us down the dark alley. The deer longs for drink. The dog is in the belly. And we don't know what to do. And we lie in the bed and awake and find no one there. So where is the beloved? Suffering awakens in us a deeper longing to be with the divine. Think about the lover who wakes. What does the lover do? The lover's already consumed with the beloved, right? They're already doing all the silly things, writing poetry, laying down in the countryside and doing that. And then when the beloved is gone, is the longing for the beloved greater at that point? Certainly. The longing for the divine becomes even greater in that moment of suffering. Or that's how the medievals thought of it. But we, in the moment of the dark night, don't always recognize that. And that's what John tried to tell his audience, who was often other members of his religious community. I remember when I was in a parish, I was just it was my first call, I had just been there a few days, not very long really, and an elderly member of the congregation who I absolutely loved, he was a great guy, and his wife, who was equally as beautiful and wonderful, she had a stroke one day and went to the hospital and was with him in this process. And they had to decide to, you know, unplug her. And when they did, I stood there and I had absolutely nothing in me whatever to say to her, to him, to give him comfort. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, when I married her, I told her I would love her till the day we died. I see now that I was wrong. Because beyond death, I still love her and long for her even more now than I did then. Even though my heart feels empty, I can only long with every fiber of my being for that day when we will be reunited and I'll find peace once again. One of the greatest pieces of literature, I think, is Augustine's Confessions. In the highlight, for me, one of the highlights of Augustine's Confessions is in Book 5, where he tells the story of a friend of his. His friend is had been recently converted to Christianity. Augustine wasn't at that same place in his own mind. And his friend is dying. And Augustine goes to him and starts joking about, oh, he'll be fine, don't worry about this. And his friend said, no, this is a sickness unto death. And his friend actually dies. And Augustine says some of the most remarkable words that I think we can read. His ability to put his suffering into words is remarkable. He's basing some of his ideas here on Aristotle. Aristotle says that when we find a friend that's truly close to us, we are like two people with one soul. Have you ever noticed that? You move away from a friend and come back, and it's like you've never been away. You know? It's because you have the same soul, says Aristotle. Augustine believed the same thing. Now, remember that image that he and his friend are both one soul. Augustine writes, when my friend died, I became a problem to myself. Everywhere I went, I could find no place to lie down my half-bloodied, lacerated soul. It bled, and I felt pain, and there was nothing I could take comfort in, because, indeed, I had lost half of my own self. Rumi's quote that I had a few minutes ago is a stark and a rather odd sort of poem, but it comes back to this notion of experience. Rumi says, sorrow comes like a friend into the room, and you need to greet it, because in greeting it, it will clean your house of the old joys and make room for the new joy. John Towler, in one of his sermons, a different sermon, tells of a vision that one of his sisters had. He says, there was a certain sister of our order of the Dominicans. She had longed to be in the presence of God, and God and all God's graciousness granted it to her. So the Lord appeared to her in a dream as a child in a manger. And she went over in her great joy to embrace the child, so that she might feel its joy. But when she came upon the child and looked closely, his robe was one of thorns. In order to embrace him, she must pierce herself with the thorns and sufferings and bitter pains that are Christ's and ours in life. What do you think she did, my friends? She took him up in her arms and in suffering found love. I don't know if you know the work by Luther. It's one of the last of his in his writings. It's late in his life. And Luther writes a work called On the Councils and the Churches. And he's trying to figure out what the church is. And he says in this document, he says, well, the church has seven marks. The first mark is that we possess the word of God, the wonder of the word. The second is that we as Christians baptize. The third, we offer the Lord's Supper. Fourthly, we have the office of the keys, confession and forgiveness, so that people might find freedom. Fifthly, we call pastors to lead. Sixthly, we pray. But the seventh is the most important. The church possesses the cross, which means we suffer. Luther writes, Christians must endure every misfortune and persecution, all kinds of trials and evil from the devil, the world, and the flesh. Inward sadness, timidity, fear, outward poverty, contempt, every kind of illness and weakness. Only in this are we truly the body of Christ. This too is the holy possession whereby the Holy Spirit makes us God's people and blesses us. For Luther, the church can't even be the church without being without suffering. For John of the Cross, the dark night of the soul brings us into the place of longing, a longing that is so great that sometimes it's not fulfilled, and we live in painful agony like the deer before the stream. And what is it that we long for? In all our thirst, to lose ourselves in the drink. When will it come? Unexpectedly. Maybe only in short moments in this life, says John of the Cross. It is a dark night after all, but the morning will be at hand when we will truly drink and lose ourselves in the divine. Let me stop there and see if you have any thoughts or ideas or maybe observations. This is a kind of a medieval way of thinking about suffering, and it's probably a little bit different than something you've heard before.
On a scale of 1 to 10, you have medieval times and you have modern times. The standard of medieval times to me seems to be suffering, and the standard of modern times seems to be avoidance of suffering.
The number one commercial on television? Pain relievers.
Yeah.
And we want to avoid suffering, right? I think it's part of why we're in this political mess, right? Nobody wants to suffer,
exactly.
So let's bail everybody out, and it just gets worse. Remember Kennedy's great speech, asking about what we can do rather than, but I think suffering is something we tend to avoid. We tend to avoid pain, and yet Lewis's comment about pain, he has this book on the problem of pain, which Lewis later says he's not too sure about, so you want to read the later Lewis and that book together. But Lewis says, really pain is a way, it's an important thing. We have doctors in the room, right? Pain is an important thing. If you can't feel pain, there is a symptom where people can't feel pain. I don't know what the disease is, but we had a kid in Fargo that this little girl couldn't feel pain, and it was a terrible problem for her, right? Because she didn't know if she was cut. She didn't know if she broke her arm. She just kept playing or whatever. And so the people had to be very careful with her. Pain is a way that is something that's very important for us. It wakes us up. And even suffering brings us to the point of saying, when my dad got cancer, and it was the worst kind, and they said he's only got so much time, suddenly my life was different. I suddenly said, why am I doing all these, this and that and that, right? But we want to avoid it. And really, the only way to deal with it is to wade into it. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't feel the absence of God, or quite the opposite. We feel it quite profoundly. Lewis says that anybody who says that they don't is prideful and arrogant, or lying.
What was the next thing for Augustine, who was the one in his confession
with the brother.
Seemed to me, of the examples you read, that took us down to the greatest depths.
Yeah.
What was next?
Augustine's,
what happened to Augustine, or what Augustine did?
In a nutshell, Augustine tries to find happiness. And it's the topic of my whole talk tomorrow. Maybe we'll get to joy. So that's a great plug-in, because if I start giving away some of this, I'm going to steal a lot of my thunder for tomorrow. We'll come back to Augustine.
Yep.
Actually, he's really important in this. And you're right. This is the next step, and that's why I put joy next.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because I didn't want to leave a lot of people with suffering as the last thing I wanted to do, but it really does come in the next stage of this.
This is totally unformulated, but respond to it if you can. It seems to me that there's a difference between longing when it has a focus and longing when you lose focus.
Mm-hmm.
When your dad has cancer, there's great clarity.
Yeah,
about where your focus is, as painful as that is.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I'm interested in how to respond to the longing that has no focus. And I'm particularly thinking about students for whom everything is so relativized and kind of generic, there's no meta-narrative, authoritative word that...
I'm going to go back to the medievals, because the way the medievals would deal with that question is, well, not unlike what Chesterton says, you know. The youth of our age are basically numb and need to find a way to wake up, and as are a lot of people. But how did they get numb? Well, let's just take any of the seven deadly sins. If you go back to the Middle Ages, the easy ones are like gluttony. Let's do sloth, just for the fun of it. If you go to sloth, it really makes you numb to the world, right? I mean, look at what Holden does. I mean, I'm struck by, you know, the way when you come here and youth come here to work, they work and they realize what it means to be a part of a community, to be established, to do some work. I was talking with some of the young people and they say, I've never really worked, it was with... the group from San Antonio. Was talking to some of the kids and the pastor, and they said they've never really worked before in their lives. And they're really basically numb to the reality and the beauty of what work can be. I was talking with one of the people who was putting in some flowers out here, and there was this great smile on his face, and he had this great satisfaction, you know, with the beauty. He was wide awake in that. But youth in this sort of sloth, and that can be playing a video game for 20 hours in a row, which doesn't seem like sloth to us, but it really is, because it's not really fulfilling who they are. It's I think it's about this numbness. And so they long for that easy thing. See, the medievals always thought of it this way. And this is kind of getting back to with what your question over here about Augustine. Augustine, I would say, we pursue the passions that we can control, when the things that we can't control is the mystery of the divinity of God, right? And so I will drink a beer, which I can control, and it makes me feel good. So if I have a six-pack, I'm great. And I think that's greater pleasure. But it numbs me. My mind is less clear after the fourth beer or sixth beer than it was on the first beer, right? And so I think that's how the medievals would respond to that. It's not, there is, I mean, it's a lack of longing that really that some people have. They need a sense of longing. They have no sense of purpose. And a lot of times the longing comes through that thing that you feel passionate about, which engages you in the world. And in some way you have to suffer to be a part of it. You know, so I've been talking with people at lunches and dinners, and I'm just amazed at what people are involved in here. One woman was talking about being involved in Tanzania, others in, Terry, where you were talking about the church in Guatemala, and, you know, the sorts of things. It's not easy. You have to somehow suffer to be involved in people's lives. We don't suffer very much to do that, but sometimes it is difficult. Is that answered? I'm not sure if that's
right.
Yeah, if you're thinking, there's only really two kinds of longing in the medieval mindset. One is for the divine, and the other is for worldly things. And if you go after the worldly things, they weigh you down. And if you go after the heavenly things, they lift you up. But is it your action? There's a lot of ways to think about that. Usually, I'm suggesting that in encountering the mystery, it's something that comes unbidden. I like Carl Jung had on his desk a plaque in Latin that translates, bidden or unbidden, God is always there. But we don't always perceive God's presence, right? And there really is a longing, I think deep down a longing for something to have meaningful and purpose in life. I remember reading an article one time, the New York Times has want ads in the back, and the ad that, I'm going to paraphrase it because I can't remember it identically, but the ad, they had more people respond to it than any other ad ever in the history of the New York Times was something like this. Wanted, people to go on a dangerous journey in which they will probably die, and we can't pay them anything except for the food and that they have on their back. The risk of their death is by starvation, freezing, and drowning. And it was the call to go to the North Pole. I forget the guy's name, but you probably remember. Bird's advertisement in the New York Times had more people answer that than anything else. And why is that? It was this this longing for adventure, this longing to feel alive, that's all, this great risk. It's a very strange thing, but I think it's hard with, especially with youth today. I said it's hard for us to thirst spiritually if we don't thirst physically, and I think a lot of our youth and us, we've had so much that we don't really know what thirsting or longing even is. Yeah.
I was just thinking more about the conversation about numbness and sort of our contemporary challenge. And what I find interesting is your list of the wonder of the word, the world. We were talking about how we try to avoid suffering, but it seems like our contemporary society has so many challenges that avoid all things like nature, community, like joy, like intimacy. Avoiding our imagination, avoiding our mindfulness, our study, avoiding silence, and avoiding death, and how that seems to be a very contemporary struggle for us as human beings.
And you're completely with the medieval mystics. That's exactly what they would argue. The world moves, the way the world operates is exactly to move us away from these things. Right? And your point is exactly well taken. It could be applied to anything.
I'm struck by Luther's comfort with suffering and the sense that he included that as part of what the church needs to be about. And I wonder, as a church or as a body of Christ, how comfortable we are with one another's suffering. You know, we try to have pat answers, and we try to medicate, and we try to placate, and, you know, what is it like to just let people be in their dark night and sit with them, but not necessarily try to fix them? And is the church a comfortable place for, I know people who stay away from church when they're suffering, you know, mm-hmm. is the body of Christ a comfortable place to suffer?
Oh, think of people. I remember one of the earliest things I had to deal with as a pastor in the parish was a young girl in the church who had gotten pregnant. And she'd gone out at a party, got drunk, and, you know, had a terrible situation happen. She was, you know, date raped her and that, and got pregnant. And she dropped out of the church. And she was just completely embarrassed. And I didn't hear about what had happened. And finally, Krishner kind of accidentally let it slip. And they didn't want to tell me, you know. It's a very strange thing. And so I drove right over there. And I said, you know, well, this is wonderful. We're going to celebrate a new wife, you know. And it was a real struggle to get her, you know, just back to church. And we didn't get her back to church until after she had the baby and we threw her a shower. And we had the shower at the church. And then when she came back, it was her first time back. But you're right, people who suffer for whatever reason, you know, whatever they see. And we as a church sometimes, especially, you know, with divorce folk and all the sorts of struggle, what people who have all sorts of issues and need us desperately, the church needs to be there. We're not very good at that.
On the other hand, isn't the church almost at its best when we do respond to the needs of the
When you do, then you're exactly
and
what
it does,
the church
that happens as well.
Yeah. And it's even better if we suffer because of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, if it costs us something. Mm-hmm. That's really true. It really is at its best. I think Holden is the church. I was telling Paul the other day, I said, I think Holden is the church at its best. It gets us out and into a place where we're at a thin place. Mm-hmm. And it forces us to be awake. I mean, nature makes you be awake. We walked out tonight, there was $2 in the dough standing in front of Chalet 10. I'm going, you can't be asleep when you see that. You know, it wakes you up. Suffering does the same thing, you know, but it's in a harsher way. And I don't want to minimize it in any way. And I use some pretty powerful examples, and I hope I didn't hurt anybody, but the example of cancer, for example. You know? I mean, it is. It's a shock, you know. And we wonder, you know, we get angry. We're like Job, you know.
Isn't pride the issue, though, to a great extent? I mean, the issue with the pregnant girl is pride to a great extent, not wanting to share your weakness.
Yeah, I suppose from her perspective and from
yeah,
the church's
I was looking
perspective.
At it from her perspective.
Yeah, right. It could be. You
so
know.
It has to heal both directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what she perceives the church to be, you know, why? How did we get to that place? You know, that's. Mm-hmm. am preaching tonight at Vespers, so I'm probably going to have to go. I promise a better topic tomorrow.